That'd be good. Shall we get started? Or just okay, so I pick four. Oh, so for those who don't know me yet, my name is Yingcheng Lo. I'm a new consultant joining the Mayo Clinic Rochester service. So pretty new here, still learning a lot of things, and good to see everyone. And the first paper today will present by our fellow Lacey, please.
So, this first paper, you guys can hear me, right? Well, okay. So we're going to go below the diaphragm with this paper and focus on peritoneal mesothelioma. And compared to pleural mesothelioma, peritoneal mesothelioma has not been as well characterized. So this paper looks to define the prognostic significance of clinical, morphologic, and immunophenotype features of malignant peritoneal mesothelioma. It is a retrospective multi-institutional study of 225 malignant peritoneal mesotheliomas from 11 institutions in six countries. So for their methods, they first define parameters in different categories, including clinical, surgical, radiographic, morphologic, and outcome parameters. Under morphologic parameters, they had histotype, nuclear pleomorphism, mitotic rate, necrosis, and architectural pattern. They further went to give each case, they assigned it a composite nuclear grade. And they did that because recent studies done by this group of authors reported that survival in pleural mesothelioma was strongly correlated with a standardized nuclear grading system that combines nuclear pleomorphism and mitotic rate originally proposed by the MSK. And they proposed that this composite nuclear grading system could also provide a reliable standard for morphologic prognosis in peritoneal mesothelioma. They also stained the cases for VAP1 and Ki-67. They divided their cases into sub-cohorts, malignant mesothelium diagnosed after 2000 and those diagnosed before 2000. And they gathered their information and they ran some statistical analysis. And in their findings for their characteristics, they found that those cases diagnosed after 2000 were significantly younger female, and there was a lower proportion of biphasic and sarcomatoid tumors and a lower prevalence of tumor necrosis. And for epithelioid tumors diagnosed after 2000, they had a lower prevalence of higher nuclear pleomorphism, but no significant difference in mitotic index, composite nuclear grade, or architecture. VAP1 loss was significantly more common in epithelioid compared to biphasic tumors, and not surprisingly, a trend towards higher Ki-67 index in biphasic compared to epithelioid tumors. And so overall survival was significantly longer for patients diagnosed after 2000 than those diagnosed before 2000, irrespective of histotype. For univariate analysis of overall survival among malignant mesothelioma diagnosed after 2000, there was a significantly association with younger age, better performance status, absence of lymph node metastasis, cytoreductive therapy, HIPEC, which is a very interesting procedure where they go in and they debulk the tumor and then they fill the peritoneum with intra-abdominal chemotherapy, and then they have some poor medical student or resident sit there and shake the patient for about 2 to 3 hours. And it was also associated with peritoneal carcinomatosis index less than 27, absence of necrosis, and epithelioid histotype. And when they ran a multivariate model correcting for age, lower overall survival was independently associated with cytoreductive surgery, non-sarcomatoid histotype, and absence of necrosis. When they ran a univariate analysis of when only looking at epithelioid malignant mesothelium diagnosed after 2000, they found there was longer overall survival associated with female sex, tubopapillary architecture, lower nuclear pleomorphism, low mitotic index, and lower composite nuclear grade and a low Ki-67 index. And when they ran a multivariate model correcting for sex, age, necrosis, nuclear polymorphism, mitotic index, and solid architecture, there was a longer overall survival that was independently associated with cytoreductive surgery, lower composite nuclear grade, tubal papillary architecture, and interesting, necrosis was not independently associated with overall survival. And then also interesting is strikingly when the histotype was added and this multivariate model was plotted for histotype and composite nuclear grade, the survival curve for grade 3 epithelioid malignant mesothelioma and biphasic malignant mesothelioma essentially overlapped. When we look at disease-free survival for cytoreduced malignant mesothelioma with recurrence with univariate analysis, disease-free survival was significantly associated with low peritoneal carcinomatosis index, epithelioid histotype, absence of necrosis, and low Ki-67 index. And when they ran a multivariate model correcting for histotype and necrosis, only Ki-67 index was independently associated with longer disease-free survival. And then when we look at our epithelioid malignant peritoneal only for cytoreduced cases with a univariate analysis, longer disease-free survival was associated with absence of lymph node metastasis by radiology, low peritoneal carcinomatosis index, absence of necrosis, low nuclear pleomorphism, low mitotic count, and low composite nuclear grade and low Ki-67. And when they ran a multivariant model correcting for necrosis, nuclear pleomorphism, and mitotic index, independently, it was associated with composite nuclear grade and low Ki-67. So this paper, they suggest that they have adequate statistical power to address questions regarding prognostic relevant in morphology and immunohistochemical parameters. They believe that the improvement in the outlook of cases after 2000 is in large part due to the use of cytoreduction hypothermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And additionally, they think because there's a gradual decrease in the proportion of non-epithelioid tumors, asbestosis-related tumors, those cases that are diagnosed in men and diagnosis in older patients. And I think one of the most important aspects of the paper for us is that the data indicated that a composite nuclear grading system based on the nuclear pleomorphism and mitotic rate has prognostic value in epithelioid malignant mesothelioma of the peritoneum, like that was shown in the pleural mesothelioma cases. However, in contrast to the pleural mesothelioma, necrosis does not appear to have an independent prognostic role in epithelioid mesothelioma of the peritoneum. And also, there seems to be complete overlap of survival curves of biphasic mesothelioma in grade 3 epithelioid mesothelioma, which again emphasizes the relevance of this nuclear grading to identify the latter, the grade 3 epithelioid. And I think that was the highlights of this paper. So anybody have anything interesting to point out or
thank
the
you
future in using?
Yeah, thanks. Did they comment at all? So your conclusion on your handout was that they're proposing that we use the same class, the same grading scheme as we use in the pleura, which includes necrosis as one of the significant findings. And yet necrosis doesn't seem to be a factor in predicting survival. And of course, maybe I have to go read the whole paper, which I haven't done, but I'm wondering how they reconcile that.
So they say right here that they do it. They do see that the recommendation is to incorporate the necrosis into the pleural mesothelioma risk stratification, but it is not applicable to, from their findings, not applicable to the peritoneal mesothelioma. And I don't know if the necrosis could be, they want an like a a grading system for both. They think that would be nice, but yes, there is this aspect of necrosis that doesn't apply to the peritoneal mesothelioma, and they don't really address it.
Yeah, in their grading system here, there's only two components. One is the nuclear grade and the other is the mitosis. Each one 1 to 3 points, so adds up total 2 to 6 points. No necrosis considered in their nuclear grade. So, and I think they want to get the necrosis out of that nuclear grade. Oh, well, that's not really nuclear grading. So, and they claim that only the nuclear grade matters, not the necrosis.
So they're thinking of getting rid of it out of the pleural one. Is that what mm-hmm. they're proposing?
They don't really propose it, but I think, yeah, exactly what Dr. Lowe was saying is that would be nice if they didn't incorporate that into the pleural grading system, so you can have a grading system that's applicable to both.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I have one question is for figure one, that when they demonstrate what's the nuclear grade 1, 2, 3. And yeah, this one, if you zoom in a little bit, like to make it larger. So I feel like the B, which is a grade 2, is a more our like typical bread and butter mesothelioma, and C is a higher grade. But the A, when they say it's lower grade, it looks like they have like higher NC ratio, probably the nuclear probably more bland, but the overall architecture and growth pattern is not similar as what we normally see as a nodule. So wondering what other people's comment on how often see this kind of grade 1 tumor.
Well, yeah, I agree. Grade 1 tumor looks like it's in collagen.
They also didn't take them. Are they all taken at the same power? It says 400. Okay, I guess they are. Okay.
I would say that first one almost looks like a small cell variant.
Yeah.
Mesotheliomas often get small like they're in collagen. You can see there's dense collagen around that one.
Mm-hmm. Any other points or comments anybody wants to make about this paper?
Well, I haven't been doing this for a while, but how many people are grading mesotheliomas in their routine diagnosis?
I am. This is Henry. Nobody's asked for it, but I've been doing it.
It will, it's going to come out in the new WHO. I had it on the docket for the last year to talk about it at the section meeting if we started grading, but we haven't.
So I have a question. You know, as Ingen said, the panel B doesn't look like all that bad. You know, it's like a regular mesothelioma, while the C panel looks really bad. And I haven't graded epithelioid meso, but when you see something like C, I kind of comment and, it may be not as good as like those A or B, my question is, did the grade 2 really was different from grade 1 in the paper? The prognosis wise. Hard to believe,
At least they didn't mention there was any significant difference, statistical significance.
Grade 2 versus grade 1. That's what
grade
I'm
2 versus, yeah, they didn't.
So we don't have to worry about that. Grade 2.
Let's see. Next table.
Next table, okay. Thank you.
Next, sorry. Probably to keep going down. I can't remember what table, but I remember I saw one table that have group one.
I think it's once you have a composite
here.
When you have a composite, I mean,
yeah, go down a little bit.
When you have a composite, you have a grade 2, or a grade one.
Yeah, grade one, two, three,
score, yeah. If your mitotic score is low, you'll kind of wind up with a low overall composite, I think, anyway.
Oh, that's better. I mean, that's reassuring because, you know, I struggle.
Yeah, the Hartz ratio of grade one and two show 1.9. So have some difference. Okay. Sounds good. Thank you.
I'll stop sharing.
And let me share my screen. Okay, so that was okay. The second paper that I want to discuss, it's also neoplastic. So this talk about STAS. So in the background, STAS, it's more and more people will right now consider general consideration as a manifestation of lung cancer aggressiveness in general. And but the real nature of STAS is still the widely debated. So there's a different debating point, like is it really true in the patient, what it happened, or is it processing artifact that includes from the manipulation from the surgeon, or the gross specimen, the gross handling from the pathologist, and both including grossing and tissue processing. So there's several factors could cause this potential effect. And so there's a lot of debate over there over the years. And for this manuscript, their thought is to look at one or two factors. One is the knife carryover. So there's a lot of talk about like kind of like when we cut food in the kitchen, the knife will bring the food particles through to the deeper level. So they want to address that. They want to do an experiment kind of thing to see if there's really the knife they carry over. And then the second, not very carefully addressed, it's the fixation issue. So the method is they prospectively look at 51 surgical resected fresh lung specimens harboring an easily palpable tumor. And they do palpitate it. So there's still that component of manipulation. And then they cut it and they make sure they have sufficient lung parenchyma around the tumor. And then they exclude the neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So what the design is, they do a first cut, use a knife, which is perpendicular to the pleura to the center of the tumor, just one cut, and avoid the seesawing effect. And then they change the blade. So, but the picture looks like they are cleaning or wipe the blade, but I think they say is they change the blade to a new blade. And then use a totally new blade to cut a parallel cut right next to the initial cut. Again, just one clean cut. So then they get a slice from here. And then this slice, the tumor is supposed to be in the middle. And they call this the upper portion, and this is the lower portion. So the thought is the knife only go from the upper to the lower once, and then the other knife go from the other side, upper to lower. So theoretically, there should only, if there's a carryover, the direction will be from upper to lower. So they want to compare the upper portion and the lower portion to see if there's stats difference, to address if this is really the knife carryover effect. So fresh upper, fresh lower, two cassettes. And then they formalin fix the specimen for 24 hours and use another new knife to cut another parallel cut and make a fixed upper and fixed lower cassette. So there's like four cassettes for each specimen. And their result is in these 51 cases, 33 of them are STAS positive. So positive in either of those four cassettes. So 64% of them have STAS. And they put in a table is from in those 33 cases, they are STAS positive. The fresh upper is about 60%. fresh fixed upper 61%. And you can see across the board, they are all about 60 some percent. And if you combine the fresh and fixed, it goes to about 80%. So what they claim here is if you compare fixed and fresh, the percentage is similar. So they claim that it's not related to a fresh specimen or fixation issue. And then the second conclusion they want to draw is the upper versus lower. So you can fresh upper versus fresh lower, about 60 some percent, and fixed upper, fixed lower, about 60 some percent. Combined upper, combined lower is about 80 some percent. So even though there's a very, very slight slight trend that the lower have a little bit more than the upper, but in general, there's no statistic difference in terms of upper or lower, fresh or fixed. So their conclusion is the stats effect is not because of the knife. So the result here, they say about, and after that conclusion, they also have other results saying the stats predominant pattern is a cluster pattern instead of the single cell pattern. And then about half of them happen in the near alveoli, which from the second to fifth alveolar space, and half of them are beyond the fifth alveolar space. No significant difference of the peritumoral lung tissue alterations is noted, mainly in the atelectasis, emphysema, or other airspace filling process have any difference between the stats positive and negative cases. And the last thing is they count like how many cells in one tumor cluster in the stats. The average is about 9, and then the mean is about 21 clusters. So one of my argument for that conclusion is, so they compared upper and lower and say the percentage is similar, but I found it tricky because if you take all 33 cases that are called positive, the upper one only have about 60% that is positive in the upper, only about 60% that's positive in the lower. So those are the 33 cases they call stats positive. Means the upper have about, in 33 cases, like 20 cases are positive in upper, 21 cases are positive in lower, means only 8 cases are positive in both upper and lower. Means there's about a 65% disconcordance of stats calling in those 33 cases, which only either upper or the lower is positive, but the other one is not. So my argument is it means this way of stats evaluation is pretty, inaccurate or varies a lot. Even though you put in all cases together, the number looks in a population wise, the number kind of balance out. But in individual cases, if you only look at the upper or only look at the lower, the disconcordance rate is more than 65%, which is like scarily high. So this either means this method is not a great evaluation for stats. And then they make me worry like the whole number or evaluation is probably have a lot of variation. That's my personal point and welcome discussion right after. And then the other discussion is they compare like different stat status and other clinical pathological characteristics, and they found there's no any significant association with stat status to any like stage or other clinical pathological characters. And they did not show any significance between the high and low stats group versus other parameters. So kind of this argue against the overall thought that stats is generally considered as one of the manifestation of lung cancer aggressiveness, because it looks like they are not associated with anything, at least in whatever they look. unless if we want to talk about recurrence, that this is not discussed because this is a snapshot of what happened at the moment. So it doesn't correlate, but those patients potentially can recurrent earlier or more aggressively metastasis, but at least not at the time of the surgery. And so take-home hemostasis probably is not because of pathology-related artifact, both including the knife and the fixation. However, I feel the evaluation is a little bit tricky. Any thoughts or discussion, comments?
Somebody spent some time thinking up a pretty tricky study.
That's a pretty high percentage. I just don't think, well, we're not calling it at that rate, I don't think. How about the rest of you?
I sure haven't seen it at that rate.
It's,
you know, they're picking tumors that are deep in the lungs. So they're picking big tumors that are probably more poorly differentiated. Did they give any information about the differentiation of the tumors?
I don't think they mentioned about the differentiation. The stage-wise, more of them are earlier stage. So more stage one and some stage two, very few stage three. So I think most of them, like probably half of them are less than 3 centimeters. And probably 80% of the case are less than 5 centimeters based on their stage.
They didn't have any information on the histologic subtypes at all?
Histological subtype, I don't think so. I think they are adenocarcinoma. Oh, no, sorry. There is, kind of forgot, there is 70% adenocarcinoma, 25% squamous cell carcinoma, 4% large cell neuroendocrine, and one case of atypical carcinoid.
Among the adenocarcinoma subtypes, they didn't differentiate.
Correct.
So, you know, they didn't do follow up, just like H6, the type and all those things. Right. I mean, what?
Correct. Yeah. So they don't have follow up. So this is a snapshot type thing. Look at if there's stats and the current information.
I see. Mm-hmm. So I agree. That's awfully high percent tish for the stats overall.
Mm-hmm. Like 60%+ of stats. Mm-hmm. I feel it's in the higher end. That is reported that is test positive.
So they didn't just take consecutive cases, right? They probably handpicked them.
So I remember in one of them, they said during that period of time, there's probably like 80 or 90 cases total, and they picked 51 cases that have enough parenchyma, both upper and lower, because some are very close to the pleura that they will not have the upper parenchyma that's enough for them to evaluate.
I'm going to have to read the paper because I'm not sure I understand what they were doing with upper and lower. I don't get it. I just don't. Mm-hmm. But I'll read the paper.
Thank you.
I think, Henry, I think that just refers to the direction where the knife was coming from.
Yes, knife come from here to here.
And so the assumption that in the lower part, if it was transfer, you would have more stas, quote unquote, in the lower part if your knife is going from up to down through the tumor.
Yeah.
Yep. Can you remind me what was the definition for stas in this study?
They use the same definition. I think it's more than one alveolar space. See tumor like away from the main tumor,
more than one alveolar space, because there are various papers use various definitions. So when we talk about stas in your practice, are you using the same definition? Or I just checked the old 2015 WHO and it doesn't define stas.
I think in the CAP protocol, it's defined.
And what's the definition? One
alvar. I can't remember. I just look at it every time I look at the tumor.
I think they mention it's more than one airspace. Okay, I think, dude, thank you everyone. And I think I want to move to the next paper. So next paper is a non-neoplastic. And so this is look at the microbiome. So because the microbiota thing is pretty hot in many organ system, especially in the gut. And also in the lung, there's a lot of interesting look at those microbiomes in different disease to see if there's association. So this paper is focused on look at chronic HP and to see their microbiome profile and compare that with IPF and control. Because in IPF, in the previous publications, that IPF, the microbiome profile does have some correlations with prognosis. So in general, the background is that the microbiomes in the IPF does associate with the prognosis. The one of the most important factor is the bacterial burden, which is the more bacteria in the BAL, the more severe or worse prognosis for those IPF patients. That's the main positive finding in the past. And then look at the chronic hypersensitivity to look at their microbiomes compared to IPF and control, because this field is less studied. So yeah, so that's the talk about the hypersensitivity in the 1990s. And then they look at the airway microbiome by take the BAL and do the 16S NGS study. So their method is they recruit 110 chronic hypersensitivity pneumonitis case and 45 IPF cases and 28 control. And they all went over a bronchoscope and take the BAL and isolate the bacteria DNA and do two things. One is to quantify the amount of bacteria DNA by qPCR and the 16S ribosomal RNA sequencing to see the different species or family genes of the bacteria. So this is one of the most important result is they look at the bacteria burden. So it means like how much bacteria DNA can identify from the BAL of the control CHP and IPF patients. They found the IPF patients have significantly more bacteria burden compared to chronic HP and compared to control. And chronic HP also have more bacteria burden compared to control. And however, if look at the survival or other prognosis factors, the bacteria burden does not have correlations with the survival in chronic HP versus control, unlike IPF. So that's the first one. And then the second one is they do the 16S ribosomal NGS and look at the different microbiome profile and found that IPF compared to chronic HP compared to control, IPF have this Veronella has more and the actinomyces have significantly more than the other two group. And chronic HP have staph significantly higher than control and IPF. So that's just an observation, but there's not much underlying mechanism or explanation proposed here why those two correlate with IPF more and why staph correlate with chronic HP more. And so some discussion is that IPF and CHP populations are actually different because the IPF, way more of them are male than female. And chronic HP have more female than male in their cohort. So even though their age and the DLCO, which is like the fibrosis amount, it's matched. But the CHP patients in their cohort have better FVC. and also like the age, the gender is different. So could this play a role in the microbiome profile, female and male? It's possible. And that's a confounding factors. And the other thought is this, again, this is a snapshot study that at that time, what's the microbiome profile compared to this, comparing these two diseases. So it doesn't explain is the cause or the consequence of the disease. More of those microbiome will cause CHP or IPF, or is the disease itself cause the population of the microbiome change? They just see correlation, but not really the cause or consequence. And my another question is, I don't know what their health control patients are. They're like truly healthy volunteer, or they are come from other disease and a surface control. I don't see that info in the paper for that. So the take home message is the profile is different, but the bacteria burden is doesn't have predictive survival in CHP compared to IPF. Welcome comments and discussion.
For the healthy volunteers, was there any kind of information regarding smoking status? You know, the IPF patients are more smokers, and CHP patients are less than them. You know, at least not active smokers. Was there any?
I forget seeing that, but I think there's a status here. And I think there's no difference between those population, even though I'm thinking chronic HP normally have more that's non-smoker. Yeah, CHP have more non-smoker.
The controls were not separated by the smoking status, right?
Oh, here. Correct. Here.
You're there, okay. They're kind of mixed, huh?
Yes.
Do they postulate where these bacteria might be living, like in the honeycombing or something, and correlate with the neutrophils on BAL?
I think they didn't correlate it to the pathology level, like where is that in the honeycombing, or it's just how far the BAL can go. So supposedly in the lower respiratory tract, but I don't think it can go that far to the peripheral honeycombing part, but I don't know. That's just my assumption.
But IPF has always had a lot of neutrophils, and one of the assumption of the neutrophils was that it would related to honeycombing, and they probably didn't have pathology on these, but they would have radiologic information.
Yes, that's a good point. I think, yeah, IPF does have more neutrophils in terms of percentage compared to the other two group. And I think they briefly talk about the HP part, they have much more lymphocytes. And you can see the table here, they have more lymphocytes compared to the other group. While, as you point out, in IPF, more neutrophils. So this may, I think they discuss about the lymphocyte, but not the neutrophil, but this does may correlate with the microbiome. Okay, let me, due to the time, let's move to the last one. So this one is a very fancy thing that I try to understand. So there's a lot of digital pathology and AI things going on right now. So we try to learn all this. And this team, they try to use the whole slide training approach to improve the deep learning thing. So some background idea is that why the machine learning thing in pathology is more difficult compared to like cardiology reading the EKG or radiologist reading the radiology, because we all know that pathology pictures, there's color and there's high resolution needed. So this will create a lot of data. So like one slice, there's way more, much more data than a chest X-ray. So that is the data amount that a machine have a lot of difficulty to handle. So that's the main difficulty. And then the other problem is to do annotation. So we all know that those AI projects all need a lot of annotation. That's the bottleneck of all these, because you don't have a good training set, you cannot really train the machine, and those annotation is the problem. And why annotation is a problem is that, so we like the whole slide imaging to because they have the architecture, they have everything to train the machine. But the machine, if they use the whole slide imaging, the resolution just make the data size too big to handle. So then a lot of the machine learning algorithm now is to patching. So it means they cut the slide into multiple patches, and each patches, and then the pathology have to draw a line of where's tumor, for example. And then the patches, like, oh, those patches within the tumor, they call a positive. If it's in a benign, they call negative. And each patches to train, because now the machine can handle a smaller amount of data. And then they play on those small patches and then calculate, oh, this is a positive or negative, and then do the machine learning to call where is tumor or if there's tumor. That's the right now the most common thing. But then the problem is that this would need a lot of hand drawing annotation, like where's the tumor, and handle with the data. So a lot of thoughts want to improve this. And then a couple of years ago, there's a breakthrough is used as MIL technique, is that they don't have to really draw the contour, just call the whole slide is a positive or negative. But they still do patches because they cannot handle the large data. And then they set the number of K patches, for example, 3 patches as an example, and then use some other training models to train in the small patches to train that, and then calculate it in a whole slide, how many patches are positive. So for example, if 3 patches are positive, then they call the whole slide is a positive for tumor. If only like 1 or 2 is positive, or all patches are negative, they call the whole slide negative. So this help a little bit to not draw the contour, but just the whole slide positive, negative as a ground truth, and they can handle a much more slice. But the problem of this approach is the accuracy is not good enough, because we think about the logic is that that. So this group they try to say, okay, then let's forget about patching, let's use the whole imaging. But the whole imaging, they have problem is that, as we say, like the machine cannot handle the whole imaging and so many whole imaging. So they actually do two improvement on that. One is about the memory. So right now it's all the GPU, the graphic processing unit that is handling those imaging. And they have a much smaller memory compared to the server memory. So they can, so they want to use the system memory, which you can connect to like a supercomputer, that can have much more computational power and memory to handle the whole slide imaging. So they want to use that. But this is very slow, because you have to transfer all the data from your graphic processing unit to the server. So that's very, very slow. And if you have to compare and train, there's a lot of data moving back and forth. So that's very, very slow. So that's why all the other group cannot do that. And even this group, they want to do that, it's still very slow. So then they do a lot of those GPU memory optimization technique, which is very out of ordinary thing that I can understand. So they kind of do the group execution to queue, like whatever they want to, the program wants to do, they group those tasks together. So only do those things, they are happening at the same time together. So prevent on doing a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. So they group what the task have to do together. And so like all the machine is doing the same thing or similar things together, and then move that imaging out and then look at another image and do the similar task at the same time. And also they do some prefetch thing to queue or align the process better. So that's just a lot of technical optimization. So their claim is after all these technical improvement, they can achieve really good AUC number, which means the accuracy in calling adenocarcinoma versus squamous cell carcinoma versus a benign tissue in the lung. That's what they train, adeno, squamous, and normal. And they also test on smaller biopsy lesion in the TCGA data set in their paper. And they use a heat map thing to show this is the pathology annotation, and this is their technique. And they see like very correlate with that. And this is the MIL technique that in the past has a breakthrough, but have difficulty with accuracy to detect like smaller tumors. So very technical paper published in Nature Communication. But I think the take home message for us is that if combine a lot of, if that technique combined with some supervised the method, they can much able to take care of those large amounts of data and also without the hand drawing and labeling annotation. So more and more those kind of technique will improve the pathology AI process. And curious about, so they claim they can precisely differentiate adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, and normal. And how about the next step? Do they want to try different adenocarcinoma growth patterns there, which we have a lot of difficulty? And that's some thought for the future for those kind of projects. Comments?
No, except that it seems like we're a long way from letting the computer figure a subtype of an adenocarcinoma. You know, if here we're taking squamous versus adeno, right? That's not a, I mean, that's, a, you know, it's a step in the right direction, but.
Yes.
What is the end game here, to make diagnosis or to pick out parts of specimens for study, for example?
So right now, what they claim here is to make the, well, not, they really doesn't claim make the diagnosis. It's first to the kind of proof principle, they can achieve accuracy in calling the host line. And then where's the area of interest? An accurately called adeno versus squamous as the first step of histology type.
So partly try to skip the annotation part, right?
Yes. Yeah. So because that's the bottleneck right now.
Yeah. So the proof of the concept, if the AI can handle the whole slide without the interference between the analysis, right?
Yes. So use some other strongly supervised method to train a little bit, but then the whole slide just annotate, just like kind of like we do some of the catches, like just like identify this picture have a car or a bridge or something, but you don't have to draw a contour. Where is that the bridge or where's the bus? Is there something or not? Without hand drawing. Okay, if there's no more question, I think we are at the 9 a.m. here. Thank you everyone, and welcome other discussions offline.
Thank you.
Thank you,
John. Thank you, have a good day.
Thank you.